Welcome to SCOTUSCast, Collective Bargaining Agreement, Post-Decision Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On January 21, 2009, the Supreme Court announced its decision in Locke v. Karras. In this case, the court considered whether union requirements that dictate that non-members pay a service fee for litigation that does not directly benefit the local union violate the First Amendment. In a unanimous decision delivered by Justice Breyer, the court held that the First Amendment permits a local union to charge non-members for national litigation expenses, provided that two conditions are met. One, the subject matter of the extra-local litigation is of a kind that would be chargeable if the litigation were local, for example, litigation appropriately related to collective bargaining rather than political speech. And two, the charge is reciprocal in nature, that is, the contributing local union reasonably expects other local unions to contribute similarly to the national union's resources used for costs of similar litigation on behalf of the contributing local union if and when it takes place. The court found that these two conditions were met and therefore maintained that the service fee did not violate the First Amendment. To discuss the decision, we have University of Chicago and NYU Law School professor Richard Epstein. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Epstein.
Hello, this is Richard Epstein, and I'm here to talk a bit today about a case which was decided this past term in the Supreme Court, which is called Locke against Karras, who's the state controller of the state of Maine. And this is one of the many cases that have come down over the past several years, trying to figure out exactly what should be done with respect to union dues under collective bargaining agreements. In this case, between a non-member who dissents to the various activities of the union and the state of Maine, which insists that non-members contribute to the collective bargaining agreement and to the union coffers with respect to the work that is done by the union, which in some sense is job-related. It's important to understand exactly what the background of this particular dispute is, and it has to do with the tension between a collective bargaining agreement, which forces workers to contribute to a union to which they do not agree in order to prevent them from free riding on the uniform benefits that the union is able to supply to union members and non-union members alike, and at the same time to respect the rights of free association and speech, which individual workers who dissent from the union's political agenda want to be able to assert. And so the question has always been, how do we figure out which of these speeches are going to be regarded as political, and which of these speech expenses are going to be regarded as associated with the normal activities of the unions? Now, this turns out to have some fairly straightforward cases and some delicate cases. And the straightforward cases have generally been those where the individual non-member has been required to contribute to the negotiation and to the litigation with respect to the collective bargaining agreements that have been negotiated by the union representative. The issue then comes up, what about political activities, and what about those activities that go to activities that are done by the national union, which may or may not be done on behalf of the local union to which the non-member is forced to make the contributions? And in this particular case, the collective bargaining agreement between Maine and the respondent had a bunch of provisions in it which said that the workers who were not union members had to pay a service fee which was calculated in order to equal the portion of union dues related to ordinary representational expenses and activities, including those which were conducted at the national level. And then what it did, in effect, is it took some of the monies that were collected at the local level and shipped it off to the national level, but only with respect to those kinds of activities which involve litigation and administration of the collective bargaining agreements. This is actually quite a sophisticated agreement, and the question that was raised was whether or not, when you put it in this particular form, all of these monies that are spent at the national level should be regarded as impermissible, or whether or not this should be regarded, these expenditures, rather, should be regarded as appropriate under the circumstances, given the indirect benefit that they supply to the local union. And the Supreme Court had to deal with this in the light of some earlier precedents, mainly a case called Lenhart, where the law was left a little bit unsettled. And essentially, the earlier positions were threefold. Well, one of the positions was that the moment you give the money for litigation expenses to the National Union, it turns out that they are inappropriate and these things should be excluded from the union dues. And this seems to be very, very broad because National Union operations can often be dealing with matters that concern collective bargaining agreements. And then the other position that you could possibly take in an extreme is to say that these things should be allowed only under the circumstances where they're appropriate to the union arrangement and not to worry about how direct they are. And the final position says, nope, they have to be exactly direct so that what they're doing at the national level is for the immediate and direct benefit of the local union and therefore the non-members in that union. So ultimately what happens is the distinction turns on the choice between two words describing expenditures at the national level. One of those words is direct, which is a fairly restrictive test, and the other is ultimately or indirectly, which is a more generous test. And in the earlier decisions, there was no mention made about how the overall system played out. And the great contribution that was made in this case individually by unanimous court, I might add, was that they added a second condition to the indirect test, saying you have to be confident that in the long run, there's going to be a level of reciprocity such that if you are required to contribute to national expenditures, which are spent on non-union members and union members and other locals, they're going to be subject to the same kind of restriction. And this strikes me as being completely correct. Here I'm in agreement with the unanimous Supreme Court. What the reciprocity provision does is it means that there's going to be no implicit transfers from the members of one set of locals to the members and non-members of another set of locals. And so therefore, what you're doing is you're creating what might be regarded as a kind of a long-term Pareto improvement that every union member is going to be improved in his tangible aspect by what is happening at this level. The only quibble that took place on this case was whether or not there was going to have to be a concurring opinion in this case, and it turns out that Justice Alito did in fact write the concurring opinion, which the Chief Justice and Justice Scalia joined, and the only issue that they were concerned with was to make it very clear that what counts as reciprocal was still a question that had to be worked out in future cases, but since it hadn't been raised here, there was no particular problem. At a more general level, what this case kind of shows is that when you get these sort of mid-level disputes at the Supreme Court, which don't have a high degree of explosion associated with it, unanimity is often the norm. And often they come out with exactly the right kind of results with the right kind of reasoning. And this is a kind of a contrast to the very highly charged discussions about the Supreme Court that take place, for example, in the recent nomination hearing of Sonia Sotomayor. And one understands all of that and therefore comes up with the conclusion that business as usual at the Supreme Court is not going to be unduly affected by the way in which these cases come out. At a larger level, the other question to ask is, do we really like this sort of long-term system of public unionization in the first place? And that's been resolved by the constitutionality of the National Labor Relations Act. It's something to which I am, in fact, profoundly uneasy about because of just one short-term kind of consideration. Let's suppose that you have a non-union member. And what this particular person believes, quite simply, is any time a union succeeds in a collective bargaining agreement, I may get a few dollars into my pocket, but it basically reinforces a structure of negotiation that I think to be inappropriate. At this particular point, that worker has no recourse whatsoever against that position. And so what you have to give up by using all of these tests in Locke and similar cases is the notion that the absolute resister has an ability to opt out entirely because there's no way that he could turn back the benefits, and so therefore he's not allowed to escape the costs. And that is essentially the way in which it has to be so long as you're going to allow any form of collective bargaining arrangements at all. And if the Supreme Court were prepared to take that issue under consideration, I guarantee that the Locke case would have received a lot more attention than it did.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. For more episodes of SCOTUSCast, as well as audio and video from past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.